So congratulations to both of the Zaz Award recipients, and to follow up on a couple of comments I mentioned earlier in reintroducing Bob Higgs. At the time of 9/11, we had an issue of the Independent Review in the mail. And for those of you who are not familiar with the journal, Bob occasionally has a column at the end of the journal called Etceteras. And this particular issue had a column which I believe was called something along the lines of, "The Cold War is over, but U.S. preparation for it continues." And it was basically a look at defense spending, U.S. defense structure, and so on and so forth, the military-industrial complex as far as defense contracts and weapons systems and so forth, and what does this have to do with the world? Because the Soviet Union had collapsed, et cetera, et cetera. But it has nothing to do with what might be a real threat, which could be a suitcase bomber. So we had this in the mail, and I remember calling Bob, I think the day after, the day of 9/11, and I asked him what he thought was likely to happen, and I forget the exact words, but something along the lines, it would be probably a textbook case of this crisis in Leviathan thesis. So we issued a press release the next day with quotes from Bob about what he thought was going, essentially to warn people what was going to happen. And one thing led to another, and he ended up getting involved in a debate with Michael Barone in the Wall Street Journal, where Barone was claiming that Bob's prediction that this crisis would monger an huge explosion of special interest politics and pork and spending and trampling on constitutional liberties and so on, Barone's view was that it wasn't going to happen because Republicans controlled both houses and the White House. Bob didn't buy it. And we were one of the very few groups in the whole country that was trying to make these points, as well as critically looking at the nature of the larger issue of war and so on. And everything that Bob was saying has come true. It's really an eerie thing. And this one book I mentioned called Resurgence of the Warfare State, Bob started doing a series of articles, partly just a sort of vent, I suspect, commentaries on what was happening and what he thought might happen in the course of a number of years. And we published this book as a real-time presentation of these many issues, and including airport security and cluster bombs in Baghdad and spending and all sorts of things. And it's eerie just to read this. The reason I mention that is because I think this insight relates to Bob's deeper understanding of the nature of government power, which again gets us back to this new book of his. So I'm glad to reintroduce Bob Higgs.
Thank you again, David. And thank all of you for coming out tonight. I don't have anything to do with marketing at the Independent Institute, so often I don't see the products of the marketing until the world does. And some time ago, I saw that this evening's program was being announced as not only the presentation of the Zaz Awards, but something called an Evening with Robert Higgs. And that's when I began to get nervous. And I thought, that seems to call for singing or dancing or some stand-up comedy or any number of things I'm completely unqualified to do. And so I'm here tonight with some trepidation. I'm here with additional trepidation because I did prepare a presentation for you tonight with a lot of visual displays. Over the years, I've discovered that one way to divert people from my poor public speaking is by using visual displays to give them something to look at. And so I'd prepared a number of them. that I thought fell in the category of pictures that that are worth a thousand or more words. And tonight, when I got ready to come over here, I did. I'm staying with my brother over in Lafayette, and he kindly let me use one of his vehicles. So I got in it and drove over here, and left all my notes in Lafayette. So here I am, naked to the world, as it were, without any pictures to divert you. But what I'll do is, in a way, to give you a sketch, at least, of what I was going to do with the additional pictures. My most recently published book, as David mentioned, is one called Depression, War, and Cold War, and the subtitle is Studies in Political Economy. It's a little different from some of the other books of mine that have come out in recent years, in that it's aimed a little more narrowly at my fellow economists, economic historians, and others who have specialized in studying the Great Depression, the World War II period, and the Cold War, insofar as the military economy was part of all of these immense events over a long period of time. And yet, I don't want to scare you away. I think even if you're not a trained economist, you will still be able to read almost everything in the book, and even the parts that may not make sense to you, a few statistical techniques that I used, for example, won't matter. Because I've told you the punchline, and if you'd like to check on me, you can get a statistician to do that, I suppose. But at all events, this book brings together work that I've been engaged in for nearly 20 years now, and it is in more ways than one a sequel to my book Crisis and Leviathan. Which also tried to speak to my fellow professionals in history and economics, as well as to a broader audience. Sometimes I've looked back on that book and thought that I actually had more success speaking to lay people than I did speaking to my fellow economists and historians. But that's slow slogging when you try to change established views in any profession. We have Dr. Saz here to be the best model possible of how difficult that can be. But this book is divided into two parts, not quite equal in length. But the first part deals with the years basically from the mid-1930s to the late 1940s. So it deals with the Great Depression period, not the beginning of it so much as the middle and later parts, with practically the whole decade of the 1940s, which was dominated by U.S. participation in World War II. The second part of the book deals with various aspects of the Cold War, in which the political economy of warfare and preparation for warfare, what we call defense these days, had to do with the operation of the economy, with the operation of politics, with the way that the public was involved in tolerating, endorsing, accepting, urging, or otherwise somehow connecting with the politicians that made the decisions. What I'm going to do tonight is to talk a little bit about part one. So this is very, very much historical. It has to do with the 30s and 40s. And yet, it's not without some relevance to the present day. I was on the radio on Saturday with a lady at radio station KCBS in San Francisco, and one of the questions she asked me had to do with the relationship between the government's war spending and helping the economy. And I've found over the years that reporters constantly raise this question. Whenever an economist talks about war or the possibility of war, almost always this issue arises. And many people in this country, especially journalists, take for granted that war is, as the saying goes, good for the economy. And I think to the extent that lay people have thought about this issue at all, most lay people believe that war is good for the economy. And I think the principal reason people believe that, which if you step back and think about it for a minute, is almost automatically an absurd thing to believe. That what is by definition an act of large-scale death and destruction is somehow good for the economy, that the reason so many people in the United States believe this seemingly absurd idea always goes back to what they understand to have happened in World War II. On one occasion, in writing an article on this subject, went through all the leading economic history textbooks, and at the time I had 10 or 12 of them sitting on my shelf, because back in my days as a university professor, I taught economic history. And so I went through all those books to see what the author said in each case about the relationship between World War II and the Depression. And virtually every one of those books had a sentence that read as follows, almost in these words, the war got the economy out of the Depression. End quote. And these are not lay people. These are professional economic historians. These are all authors who have PhDs in economics or history, who spent years and years reading the literature. They're not distilling this idea from the air. They're basing it on the products of research and writing and other historians' conclusions. And it's just a fact that professionally, as well as among lay people, the idea that World War II got the economy out of the Depression is taken to be a well-established fact. Well, very early on in my career, I began to doubt this. It didn't seem to make sense to me, so I began to think about it a little harder. And before long, I was teaching in my own courses that this was nonsense, this was a misunderstanding of what happened in the war, and telling the students a little bit about why I thought the existing literature had accepted this misinterpretation. But I didn't write about this issue for a long time. I was engaged in pursuing other subjects, and it really wasn't until the 1980s that I began to write anything about it, and then it wasn't very much. And only in the beginning of the 1990s did I begin to write specifically about the connection between World War II and the Great Depression. And I wrote a number of articles which appeared in professional journals, several of them in the Journal of Economic History, which is the leading economic history journal in this country and perhaps the world. And those became raw materials for what appears in this book. The book is a collection of past writings, but I will say in its defense that it's not just those articles, because I've reworked all of them for the occasion of their collection here and tried to bring them up to date. Yet it is still a collection, essentially, of articles and chapters published over almost 20 years. And I didn't realize as I went along that in a sense I was putting together a project that had coherence. Maybe in the back of my mind there was some kind of coherent plan that kept telling me, work on this part of it, now work on that part of it. But finally I reached a point where it looked to me as if I'd told most of the story or dealt with most of the important aspects of it. And that's when I decided that it might make sense to pull all of these trees together and represent them to be a forest. So that's what you find here. Now, let me just pose three questions to organize my remarks for a few minutes here. We could start off by saying, what caused the Depression to last so long? The Great Depression was unlike any other business bust in U.S. economic history. By far different. The second worst business depression in U.S. economic history was the one that took place in the mid-1890s. It was not nearly as deep, and it was less than half as long. So it doesn't really bear comparison. And all the others were even less severe. So the Great Depression is really unique. Economists like to treat this as a depression among many depressions, and there's an organization called the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is looked to as the kind of official arbiter of the business cycle. They're the ones who tell us when the downturn starts and when it is finished, and the upturn starts, and then when we start another cycle, and they have all these official dates that then get plugged into economic analysis in various ways. So if you look at their kind of view of economic history, you'll see several dozen depressions over the last 150 years. But most of them hardly were noticed even by people living at the time. They were so minor. They were so short and so shallow that not very many people at the time even thought, well, we're in the midst of a business depression this year. So the Great Depression is different. It deserves, I think, to be viewed as a unique event in its magnitude. So question number one I would raise is what made it last so long? The second question would be, was the U.S. economy prosperous during World War II? And the third question would be, why was the U.S. economy generally prosperous in the decades after World War II? If I had just put those questions on the table somewhere for economists to walk by and look at, I think probably none of them would have looked at the questions and thought, in order to answer those three questions, we need to think about all three of them together. The only way we can make sense of why the economy lasted so long is to contrast it with, say, why the economy was generally prosperous after World War II. I think very few of them would have even paused over question number two. Was the economy prosperous during World War II? Obviously. Everybody knows that. Even the people who lived in the United States at that time apparently all believed that we were enjoying prosperity. So here we are. There's virtually no one to dispute it, so that should be a settled issue. Why even bother asking the question? But what I argue in the book is that to really understand the correct answers to these three questions, we need to think about this whole period in the United States from the mid-1930s to the late 1940s. And to understand any part, whether the Long Depression, the nature of the war economy, or the prosperity after the war, we need to see all of it as part of one picture. And what I've developed in the book is an interpretation that allows us to do that. Now, I'll try to explain quickly the nature of my interpretation. I don't have my displays here to give you the pictures that are worth thousands of words, but I'll try to give you an idea of the magnitudes involved in some of the events I'll mention. We all know, of course, that the Great Depression began in this country about the middle of 1929. Lay people think it began when the stock market crashed, but that was actually something that happened after the economy had reached its peak and begun to decline some. And no doubt, the stock market crash occurred, in part at least, because people began to perceive that the economy had reached its peak and begun to decline. Although there were short reversals on the way down, it continued down almost relentlessly for the next 4 years. Generally hit bottom around the first quarter of 1933. Now, that is an extraordinarily long period for things to just get worse and worse and worse. In fact, the bottom seemed to be falling out, because 1930 wasn't too bad. But 31 was quite a bit worse, and then 32 was a lot worse. 32 was the biggest single-year drop in gross domestic product that had ever occurred up until that time that we've measured. And so if you try to go back and put yourself in the place of the people who were living at that time, you can begin to appreciate how they might have felt. That the machine was broken, that as they often said in those days, capitalism didn't work anymore. More and more men were unemployed. More and more factories were shut down. More and more people were unable to pay their mortgage payments and had foreclosures on their homes. More and more farmers couldn't pay their taxes or their debts when they were due, lost their farms to lenders or to tax collectors, and it seemed that it was never going to end. So people became very, very desperate, and they were almost en masse demanding some kind of relief from the government. Now, it wasn't that the government did nothing to provide some ostensible relief. In fact, the Hoover administration was, despite the mythology that grew up around it as a result of the work of historians like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., people accuse Hoover and his administration of doing nothing. That's completely wrong. Hoover was the most interventionist president in this respect that the country had ever had. No previous federal administration had ever acted in any decisive way to relieve or reverse a business downturn. But the Hoover administration did a variety of things to attempt to turn things around. Now, what it did, unfortunately, and I'm not going to dwell on this because this is not really part of the story I'm telling right now, but the actions the Hoover administration took were almost all, maybe all, more harmful than helpful. So those actions had a great deal to do with the fact that this business downturn, unlike those in the past, did not reverse itself in a year or so after a small slide downward, but got worse and worse and worse because the government was helping it get worse. Probably one of the most destructive things that the Hoover administration did was that immediately in November and December of 1929, the president called together the leaders of a number of big businesses and labor organizations and farm organizations, and Hoover, who was not a dummy like a typical president. He was actually a well-informed man, certainly by the standards of his day, had to be viewed as probably the man better prepared to become president of the United States than anyone had ever been before, as so far as his expertise, his knowledge, his experience. Hoover had developed the idea that it was destructive during a business downturn if the employer started cutting real wages for workers. So what happened was that as the demand for the products fell of these various firms and their real wages stayed the same, the only way they could protect themselves from huge losses was by laying off more people, which they did. So unemployment grew much quicker than it would have if wages had been allowed to fall as they had in the past. Many other things were done I won't go into. Many of you are probably familiar with the monetarist argument that the Federal Reserve was the biggest villain by allowing the money stock to fall by about 30% during this contraction. And although there are some dissenting economic views with regard to that particular issue, I myself tend to agree with the monetarists in that respect. I think the fact that the Fed, which was supposed to be the lender of last resort, allowed 10,000 banks to go bankrupt in 4 years made things worse than they would have been otherwise. So the collapse of the financial system had enormous repercussions through the whole economy, and the Federal Reserve has to be held responsible for permitting that to happen. It was in a position to offset it if it had acted appropriately, and it chose not to do so. But at all events, we ended up in a very bad situation. Real gross domestic product had fallen by about 30%. Prices had fallen, depending on the price you looked at, anywhere from 20 or 25% on down to as much as 60 or 70% in some industries. Farm prices on average fell about 60%. Prices of many export goods fell by 40 or 50%. So if you put yourself in the place of people who were selling products at the time, this was just awful. So they were in a very bad shape, and as a result, many of them went broke. So by 1933 and 34, this desperation had reached a very high level. Everybody who had any political organization whatsoever was crying out for some kind of relief from Washington. And what they were seeking was the only kind of relief they understood. It's the kind they had always lobbied for in the past, which was specific relief to their particular kind of people. The farmers were asking for some kind of relief for farmers. The manufacturers wanted relief for manufacturers. The exporters for exporters, and so on and so on. The bankers wanted banks to be bailed out. People weren't so much going to Washington with some idea that would help everybody across the board. They presented the usual kinds of special interest political proposals that they'd often presented and occasionally managed to get approval for in the past. So we got a barrage of these people going to Washington, and everybody who had some crazy idea about how to fix things went and got a hearing, because all the old experts were discredited. All the old experts were the people who said this can't happen. And yet there was the evidence of your senses: massive unemployment, massive bankruptcies, massive banks going belly up. You couldn't deny that things were horrible. So it seemed that the old experts didn't know what they're talking about any more than some crank from Nebraska. And there were plenty of those in Washington, too. Well, of course, as we all know, when the Roosevelt administration took office, it did everything that the Hoover administration had done 10 times over. Just if Hoover was a proto-New Dealer, then we got the real deal when Roosevelt and his advisors took took command. So you got this huge outpouring of government programs to do everything from raising farm prices to controlling the price of petroleum to cartelizing every industry in America so that they would all be like monopolies and could raise their prices. That made sense if you looked at it one at a time. But if you think about all these industries being cartelized at once and raising their prices, and the only way they can maintain these high prices is by restricting supply. So what you're saying is every industry in America is going to cut back on the amount it produces, and you're going to cure the depression. So this whole scheme was cockamamie. It was internally contradictory, and you didn't have to be much of an economist to see through it. But in the hysteria and the desperation of the day and the eagerness of Roosevelt and his advisors and the Democrats in Congress to respond to the public outcry, all of these programs were put in place at once, no matter how much they contradicted one another, or in many cases, such as this National Industrial Recovery Act, it was self-contradictory. Well, there began to be a little recovery. And actually, the historians look back and they say, well, Roosevelt turned things around. Well, not much. Basically, a lot of industries were trying to take action before the NIRA rules got put into effect. And so they produced a little burst of recovery for a few months, and then when the rules got put into effect, the recovery stopped for the next year and a half or so, and there's very little recovery. By 37, it looked as if recovery was finally within sight. Roosevelt at that time, and now we get into my story proper, Roosevelt began to change his general way of politicking. When he first took office, he more or less tried to please everybody at once. That's how we got all these programs being put into place in 1933-34. In fact, Roosevelt wasn't particularly for or against anybody, except he was for Roosevelt. Historians like to think Roosevelt was this greatest of all left liberals. But Roosevelt was a total opportunist. Always. And what he did was not based on ideology, because he didn't have much of an ideology. He was a master demagogue and a masterful political schemer and opportunist. And in the beginning, his opportunity seemed to lie in trying to be all things to all men. And so he tried that. But because the Depression was still so severe, because unemployment was still 20% in 1935, a lot of people began to attack Roosevelt for not doing enough or for not helping certain people, particularly the downtrodden. And a variety of demagogues began to gain followings with all kinds of proposals of their own to help the downtrodden. A man named Dr. Townsend, who had a scheme to provide money handouts to old people, and Upton Sinclair out here in California had a big following with his own plan of establishing socialist cooperatives and handing out money, and Roosevelt was looking ahead to the election of 1936, of course, and thinking, I'm in trouble. I need to somehow distinguish myself from these guys and pull some of their followers away. So he began to become very anti-business. He began to attack the economic royalists, as he called them, particularly the wealthy people, the people engaged in financial businesses, investors, bankers, and he began to blame them for the Depression, and to argue more or less that they were just holding back on what needed to be done for the economy to recover in order to embarrass him. See, for Roosevelt, everything was about him. I'm not kidding. That's the way he looked at everything he saw in the world. It was all some friendly act for him, or people doing what they were doing to get him. There's something about politics and paranoia that go together very nicely. So he changed his tune, and he began to demagogue. Of course, he won the 1936 election in a landslide, and he was so happy with what had happened that he went on with this. In 1937, he came out with his scheme to pack the Supreme Court. He came forward with a proposal to reorganize the government, which basically would have allowed him to redo all the makeup of the departments and change the organization chart for the federal government. He began to blame the financial people and the investors even more than before, and he overplayed his hand. And worst of all, in 1937, occurred a depression within a depression. The economy collapsed before it had even come close to recovering, and at that point, many people blamed Roosevelt. They said, whatever he's done is not working. We've had all these years, and now we're almost as bad off as we were. We've got 20% unemployment again. The stock market has collapsed, one of the worst stock market collapses of American history in 1937-38, and they were in a pickle. So Roosevelt's enemies began to gain ground in Congress. The New Deal began to peter out. And as that happened, Roosevelt turned his attention to foreign affairs. Presidents, when they're not doing well domestically, can always divert the public with foreign affairs. And so Roosevelt began to shift his attention away from the New Deal programs. He began to spend more and more time involving himself in politics, particularly the politics of the European countries, where the settlement of World War I had virtually guaranteed a resumption of warfare sooner or later because of the terms of the Versailles Treaty. And so those chickens were starting to come home to roost by the mid-1930s as Hitler had taken power in Germany and the Germans were rearming, and everybody knew the war was going to come sooner or later, and Roosevelt wanted to be part of that. He wanted to be involved in it. Every president knows he can be a great man only if he's involved in a great war. So Roosevelt began to angle. But when he did that, he found that he had, as it were, been hoisted by his own petard, because he had spent years now haranguing business and investors, but the United States had almost no armed forces. Our armed forces numbered only about 200,000 officers and men altogether in all the different branches of the armed forces. To be a factor in a European war, we had to have huge armies and navies. And in order to do that, we had to have a lot of munitions, supplies, steel, aluminum, copper, magnesium, all the things you have to have to build and equip modern armed forces. And in order to get those things, you had to have the cooperation of big business. So at that point, he began to make his peace with big business. And particularly in 1940, after the great German successes in the spring of 1940, when they overran France and some other countries, Roosevelt got in a great haste to build up the armed forces of the United States. And in order to do that, he had to win over big business, which he did by basically creating the modern military-industrial complex. Chapter 2 of my book describes how that was done by a series of legislative actions in 1940 and 1941. And what this involved, in brief, was a variety of measures to shift the risk away from munitions producers to the government, which is to say to the taxpayers, so that these businessmen would be willing to fall into line and accept contracts to produce war goods. They weren't happy to do this in the beginning. There was great reluctance because mainly they didn't trust the Roosevelt administration. But they were won over by these legislative changes and by Roosevelt's appointment of lots and lots of business people to be administrators in the war preparation agencies. So he shifted his ground. The war did then commence. First, we weren't a declared belligerent, but we were definitely in the war from mid-1940 at least in supplying the French and the British and later the Russians in a very big way and in making all sorts of cooperative military plans with the British. So we were definitely in the war, even though war had not been declared. And Roosevelt, as you know, tried to maneuver the Germans to commit some egregious attack, and they were too cagey to be drawn into his trap. But the Japanese were eventually backed into a corner and chose to fight their way out, including by attacking Pearl Harbor. But we got the war economy. The war economy was not prosperity. A lot of people went to work. Yes. Unemployment disappeared. Yes. Where'd the men go? They went into the armed forces. Okay. In 1940, you had about 7 to 8 million unemployed people in this country. By 1945, you had 12 million people serving in active armed forces. That's all it takes to get rid of unemployment. Put people in the armed forces. The number of people who served in the U.S. Armed Forces at some time during World War II was the equivalent of almost 30% of the pre-war labor force. Well, it's easy to get rid of 10% unemployment that way. That's how we got rid of unemployment. Now, of course, all the people who weren't in the armed forces were in great demand for the munitions industries. And in the peak years of the war, about 40% of the entire U.S. labor force was occupied in either the armed forces or the U.S. civilian employment or in the war munitions industries. 40%. So the war economy produced spurious prosperity. People didn't live better. In fact, by my estimates, consumers were worse off throughout the war than they had been before the war began. Not only did they have rationing, they many goods were not produced at all. No new cars. No new appliances for their home. No new homes for people to occupy. For 4 years or more. So, yeah, they had money. They were earning money, but they couldn't buy the things they wanted with the money. Okay, that was the nature of the war prosperity. It's a fake. There was no war prosperity. There was just a huge armed force and a great number of people producing supplies for that armed force. Well, what happened when the war ended? Well, what happened was really the greatest economic miracle of all time in our history. In one single year, the production of private goods and services increased by at least 30%. In 1 year, it was never anything like that before or after. Never even anything half that big before or after. 30% in 1 year. Basically 1946. So the economy began to reconvert late in 45. By early 47, it had almost completed this changeover back from military economy to civilian economy. And when it did so, finally, all of these new dealers had been chased away during the war to win over businessmen to cooperate in running the war economy, were out of the way. And people in the investment community no longer were afraid for their property rights as they had been in the late 1930s. And therefore, they began to invest in high rates for the first time since the 1920s. I call this situation that the government produced in the late 1930s regime uncertainty, because what it was is a situation in which investors were afraid to commit their money to long-term projects because they were afraid it might be confiscated, their profits might be wiped out by taxes, by regulation, by any number of hostile government moves by a government whose president visibly hated them and whose closest advisors were zealous believers in government planning to replace the market. So that was the situation people faced in the late 1930s. Private investment never recovered. The war brought all of these more business-friendly people into positions of influence, but during the war, they couldn't do anything but produce guns and ammunition. Finally, when the war ended, the change in the character of the government, basically the passing of the full-cry New Deal, combined with the switch over of resource use from military to civilian uses and allowed investors to come out for the first time since 1929 and invest at a high rate. They continued to do so, and the fact that they were given enough room to maneuver and enough trust in the government's not attacking the nature of the market economy in a fatal way allowed the prosperity that continued for decades afterward. So that answers question number three. So let me stop there, and we'll entertain your questions.
Well, I want to thank you for your fascinating presentation. And I'm really, really curious if you can integrate in any way into your thesis the role of prohibition.
Not in a central way. What happened was that, of course, prohibition had been very controversial and widely violated. And the main reason the government decided to support the repeal of prohibition was that government revenues had fallen tremendously in the early 1930s, and the politicians wanted the money. And so they finally decided that, you know, well, let's legalize alcohol again and tax it, because up until 1913, the taxes, internal revenues taxing alcohol and tobacco products had been one of the major sources of federal government revenue, and so they knew they could get a lot of tax money from that source, and so many politicians came around to supporting the repeal of prohibition for that reason. The government was running huge deficits, and so it was scrambling to get as much tax revenue as it could find. I didn't mention, by the way, that one of the reasons why the initial slide was so severe and why the persistence was so long was because government kept raising taxes all the way through, and not only the federal government but state governments too. The federal government was collecting in 1938. It was collecting about 40 to 50% more money in taxes than it had collected in the prosperous year 1927. So taxes went up. It wasn't just all these soak the rich taxes that Roosevelt and his followers loved. All kinds of taxes. In fact, the Social Security tax, which was a tax on the first dollar of earnings anybody got, and then every dollar after that. That was a very regressive tax. These taxes on cigarettes and alcohol were very regressive taxes. Sales taxes were put into effect widely in the 1930s, more regressive taxes. So you know, people think that the Roosevelt administration favored these soak-the-rich taxes, which it did, but it also stood behind collecting taxes across the board, from poor people, middle-class people, from everybody. Nonetheless, it continued to run deficits every year, But Roosevelt never came around to the Keynesian position that deficits were themselves a good thing. He always talked as if he'd like to get rid of these deficits, and so the more money they could collect, the better.
It seems like there's a automatic mechanism here that's going, that government gets larger and larger as it has. Do you happen to have any ideas on how you can reverse that? I know that's a tough question.
Yes, I do. I don't have any formula that will allow the achievement of what is required. This phenomenon that I've been studying for 25 years or more, what I call the ratchet phenomenon, where there's some national emergency or great crisis and an outcry for government to do something about it, and government is all too happy to respond. Government comes in, institutes new programs of various sorts, and of course, whatever it does will always be tailored in a way that is designed to benefit the friends of government, you know, the special interests that have some potency with the people in power. But it'll take these actions and immediately and generally be approved for doing so. The one thing people in modern life won't tolerate is a government that does nothing. A government that just folds its arms and says, you know, anything we'd do would make things worse, so we're not going to do anything. So all governments respond. They always do something, and what they do sometimes gives the appearance of helping for a while, because indeed it does help the special interests who benefit particularly. But in the longer run, what we do is we simply, the crisis passes, but some of the emergency measures persist. And so government gets bigger and bigger. Every time there's a crisis, it moves to a higher level, and then it resumes normal growth till the next crisis when it jumps up again. And so we keep moving up in that fashion. Now, in order for this ratchet process to operate, you have to have a dominant ideology in the society that leads people to demand, or at least to approve, this do something response. Now, there was a time in the 19th century when the dominant ideology was so different that people did not favor that kind of reaction to a crisis. In fact, in my book, Crisis and Leviathan, I started with the late 19th century in order to show that at that time there occurred a very severe economic crisis, the depression of the mid-90s. It was the worst that had ever happened in this country. There were many outcries from farm groups, from labor groups, from various organized parties demanding that the federal government do something. That it support farmers, that it create some kind of paper money shower, that it regulate railroad rates or nationalize the railroads. All kinds of proposals were afoot, that it hire the unemployed to build public works. Well, the Cleveland administration, which was controlled by the old classical liberal ideology of the 19th century, basically folded its arms and said, we're not going to do any of these things because they're wrong. They won't help. The market will correct itself. They believed in the laws of the economy, that the best thing to do was leave the free market alone. And secondly, they said, look, we have a constitution in this country. The federal government has only the powers that the Constitution enumerates. And it doesn't enumerate a power to hire the unemployed. It doesn't enumerate a power to spread paper money all over the prairies. It doesn't allow us to do this even if we wanted to do it, and we don't want to do it. So they did nothing, and as a result of that, Grover Cleveland became a political outcast. And the nature of the Democratic Party was forever changed. Because what was happening was that was the last. That was the last episode in which the old ideology was dominant. growing in the late 19th century and becoming more powerful throughout most of the 20th century was the progressive ideology, the ideology of active government, of do something. First do something about crises or emergencies, then do something about everything. Do something about our mental illness. Okay? Besides the crisis state of the war making, we have the crisis of the therapeutic state that Thomas Szasz has written about so well. So more and more we have people who believe that the government is our savior, not only our savior in a crisis, but our day-to-day savior. Any trouble we have, there should be a government program to deal with it. Now, what to come back to the direct answer to your question, that ideology must be changed. Because so long as it persists and dominates people's thinking, the ratchet process will continue to operate. Politicians aren't going to refuse these popular demands and say, oh, no, that's wrong, and get voted out of office and made into pariahs like Grover Cleveland. They won't do that. If they do, they'll be replaced by people of very different inclinations. So until the existing ideology of progressivism is reversed, we are going to simply move in the same direction.